This is BCS. And suppose you had a resin at omega naught, and you want to know whether there's a peak or a dip, okay? So now, this is what you have. Unfortunately, this is complex. You've got to expand this to find out what's happening. What happens, if I remember, is at higher energy, because you have to remember BCS is large out here compared to delta. You expand this, the lead term is 1. Then there's a term that goes like this, a half delta 1 of omega squared. And then because of the imaginary part, you get this, and you get higher order terms over omega squared. So when I'm here at higher frequencies, I just expand the density states. And now what happens is if you have a phonon, the alpha squared half omega, if I'm remembering this right. Then you'll find that what happens is in the real part of the gap, when you get out near this value plus the gap, which is very small, what happens is your interaction gets very strong. And then when you get above it, remember, you're out of phase. The photon is out of phase, and so now it's repulsive, and you get this strong dip that dies out. While the imaginary part, you can imagine the gap comes on very strong where you have dissipated phonon. And so now what happens is you come down this thing, and as you get near this resonance, delta 1 is getting bigger, the binding is getting greater. And so all at once, the receptor takes off, and it's climbing. And just as you get to the resonance, delta 1 crashes, and delta 2 comes up. So this guy drives you down, this guy's falling, and so you get terrific dip, and then you come back up. And so that's the...
So the vertical axis is the density
of states. States. Exactly.
I'm sorry.
So we take all the
so, so, so now, I don't want to be taking, sorry. So this is whatever, the IED, this is the IED normalized in some way. And so that object has this structure, which is representing what we physically can understand over here. Now you take a few more derivatives, and it becomes obscure.
So what I would suggest is that I was looking for maybe a way of connecting it to the broader sort of theme of this workshop, but we might as well, if there is enough interest on the inelastic, because the ultimate goal for me was to discuss exactly the inelastic, and hopefully step into that discussion. The idea for, you know, we see now the emergence of the similar ideas in the others, in SDM, whether or not it's a stupid idea, whether we should do it, or whether we should sort of a priori not do it because it's showing couple systems, and maybe it's a fractional system, or whatever. So what do you think? We can start from a general discussion about this, or stay a little bit on the subject of the inelastic time. Which is certainly where I want to end up at the end of the day. The
question is whether we start where you want to end up, or whether we start somewhere else and end up where you want to end up. We might as well start where you want to end up.
I think you could be something specific, right? And then we can go where we want.
So I was just basically, like I said, struggling with the introduction about how to feed it in. And I think, you know, like if you look at the, what would constitute, so I can figure it out. The general statement would say, we, at the end of the day, we are successful. We solved the IPC problem. What it would mean. And obviously, it would mean many things to many people.
Sasha, what does it mean?
Exactly. I can tell you what it means in terms of, like, specific observables.
Okay, good.
So, you know, we know TCSI. This is known from very long time. We probably know by now symmetry of the order parameter. People would agree what it is. Or rising, but okay. Although there are pockets of resistance. So then, which is already good. So, so like obviously, next more microscopic higher level questions would be Do we have a detailed description of the space? Do we have a complete understanding, or good understanding of the ground space and occupation? And that's where places people can do sort of variational calculations, they can do look at the properties of quasi particles. And this is a work in progress. But I would say that actually in terms of symmetry we can safely put check. Or say there's a 95% accuracy of probability we can put a check. But we believe it's mostly D-wave, it could be some other component. And so to me the next actually question on this attempt to understand microscopic is like if you would be what is the mechanism? Like what is it so like a driver? There are a few possibilities. It could be that there is some electronic relations, it could be marginal thermoliquid. But as time goes and we see
marginal thermoliquid is not electronic correlations.
Yeah,
not sure
marginal they seem the same. Marginal thermoliquid. But what I'm saying is that
but it's not a magnet.
Yeah.
You mean the pairing mechanism?
Yeah, pairing mechanism.
Okay. Yeah. I would say that question is I would put a check on that.
On check on what?
On the mechanism.
Perfect. So what is it?
Well, the mechanism is basically singlet formation by the Heisenberg exchange interaction. That's the mechanism for the pairing, and the mechanism for the coherence is also related. It is a different scale, and they all have some strong correlations. I would say that the way we are formulating it, in terms of interacting with a bosonic mode, is kind of the wrong way to approach it, because that's a resupplying approach.
No, I think actually I disagree with you.
Because we have broken it into two parts. The first part that I said, that it's coming from the parent is basically single formation.
Yeah, it's a
D-wave,
so
I don't agree with this. But of course, parent is a single. But when we're talking about the mechanism, you don't need just something as poetic as this, but you mean as explicit.
Parrot's
calculation.
Explicit.
There are many parrot's calculations. I know we have done this, but I'm not even saying you're wrong. I'm just saying that in the end, something like that will probably be, maybe could be the right answer, but we honestly really don't know.
No, I think, I don't know, I'd like to hear
that.
What would you say?
Yeah.
Well, a comment I was going to make was to make sure I understood what you were saying. And if I understand what you find within the variational calculation is that as you get, this may be too simple a picture, but when you get very large, the popping somehow gets suppressed, giving you an effective J over T that might be bigger than one would think, and that this is then capable of giving the higher TC. And maybe that's a misrepresentation of what you found.
But see, I'm not even trying to explain the trends right now. I'm just saying that given some kind of anti-ferromagnetic exchange, you know, JS dot S, right, from that one can just do, do like a mean field factorization and get D-wave pairing, just directly from that.
If I understand what you're saying, JS, I dot S J minus a quarter N I and
yeah.
S can be factored into minus J alpha delta.
Absolutely.
And then you proceed
so
on. It seems to me that if I wanted to argue against that, I would ask that in these experiments we want to hear about, we pick up some dynamics and we learn that the scale of response of the interaction in frequency isn't U. Now, J is 4T squared over U isn't U, but that there's a lower frequency that comes in that reminds us more of the anti-ferromagnetic spin fluctuations. And that part of the dynamics, because yours is a variational calculation, is not picked up. And so the question remains, should we view it as the exchange of some simple object, or should we view it as a very strong correlated limit that I think these people and so
I think that's why
Sasha doesn't want to check it
on. I think that is an open question. As to how you connect the low doping regime, which is strongly correlated with the high doping which is kind of more in the spin fluctuation regime where indeed there is a bosonic exchange. So that's...
So I think one question is...
That connection is something
is that connection, is it... If we even believe this and throw out phonons, I mean, there's a whole group of people, maybe there's some are here, but a whole group of people we all know that are out there who will be telling us, there's phonons. There's another group of people in this building who somehow don't be here who will tell us it's fractionated. I mean, that, so I can see why.
Beautiful release is all the possibilities.
I'm not
here to build a consensus, but it's good to get out all the ideas.
No, I'm not saying we should totally check it out. Yeah. All I'm saying is, okay, there is one train of thought, strong correlation, anti-paramagnetic exchange, from that delayed single conductivity naturally come down.
I don't agree with anti-paramagnetic correlation.
You can slide down that one pathway. But it does open up other questions, okay, especially in view of this mode that we are looking for. Yeah. I think we should look for it, because clearly, I know phonons notwithstanding, there is some such mechanism as large doping. And we have to be able to explain that entire doping thing in within some one theory, I mean.
So, suffice to say that actually there is a strong opinion that this has been solved, and it's due to pure electronic relations, and maybe there is no need for any bosons. It's just short range, or you like physics on a couple of sides. Is it fair, like starting point for what you're doing? And then I would say that actually as time goes by, let me just put it on the table basically. As time goes by, we see that maybe it's not such a stupid idea that things are not fractionalized. We see growing evidence for more and more quasi-particles, and maybe there is a glue floating around. Now, this glue should have a fingerprint. It might not, it might, but basically this line of inquiry, of looking, what are the possible candidates for bosons? That's what my personal interest are. What are possible candidates for bosons that show up in the parent stage? And then I see it. And the third one was exactly fractionalization.
Now, there's a fourth one that John should speak on. I mean, the whole mechanism of how you amplify what might be any one of the things you talk about, but you really jack it up by having stripes or inhomogeneity, and that is what brings high TC. Again, Steve isn't here.
Yeah,
John. Say that in a moment. There's a whole point of view that the very important part of the mechanism is inhomogeneity or stripe or two-leg ladders embedded.
And
here I know that there's plenty of evidence.
I was just going to say, part of that perspective is that a big part of the superconductivity is not coming from an exchange of glue. It's not potential energy that's driving it. It's frustrated kinetic energy. And lowering of the kinetic energy in the superconducting state is driving it. So it's a whole different picture in that. It's a different way of thinking about things. In that.
No, I don't understand this in principle. But if I minimize the kinetic energy of the Hamiltonian, I know the answer. It's not a kinetic state.
If you do that, yes, that's the conventional picture. That's starting from
Fermi. The exact solution of a problem is trivial.
Right.
Yeah.
The question is, does that apply to the normal state of the Cooper rays?
Which side?
Sorry?
Okay.
Well, I mean, I would emphasize the endodope side and optimally doped, which is where the big pairing gap is. So if you want to understand where strong pairing is coming from, I think endodope is more interesting, but that's you can take points of view on that. But if you when people talk about quasi-particles, they're often talking about what's seen in photoemission or STM at low temperature in the superconducting state. But BCS theory is based on a Fermi liquid in the normal state. And so I think one has to consider what the nature of the electronic excitations is in the normal state. And it's not clear, I would argue that it's not clear that you have to analyze the kinetic energy in the normal state.
Sorry, we all know that the state
is Sasha. So what are you saying about the normal state?
Steve, for example, would argue that you don't have a Fermi liquid in the normal state, that you do have, that you haven't diagonalized the kinetic energy, and that's a very important part of the problem. So it's a different way of looking at it. You're saying, you haven't reduced the kinetic energy in the normal state, there's frustration of the kinetic energy. In the superconducting state, you do lower the kinetic energy, and that's what's giving you most of the pairing energy and coherence energy.
Okay, so that's a very important reaction. I don't disagree with Jim.
Just a comment of experimental facts, both in the Hanagori experiment and in the Aliastani experiment. There is interference in the normal state. That's a fact.
Well, there is quasi-particle like interference.
There are interference, but
there's a question of what you call them there. So that
means the momentum wave vector, the momentum quantum number is well defined in my opinion.
Okay, I think that's still available.
But even more, because what the experiment sees is the electron, not the fractal. whatever you're tunneling to is a real electron, right? Because that's what comes out of your tip.
So this is actually interesting also in the sense I find that unfortunately nobody from fractional light down this year, you know, like, remember the early days of IDC, there was like a full phase diagram. Full phase diagram was clustered with all these exotic phases. Let me finish this. And then as time went by and the data got better and better, the phase space for the people legitimately looking for the fractional light, so like the situation shrunk now to the critical points or in the vicinity, some. In other words, I'm saying that unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, the whole physics of this cooperate gets couched more and more in the conventional language. Whereas we started with very exotic objects in the beginning. And so I would say that actually, in the same vein, maybe kind of talking about the glue, because usually talking about the kinetic energy of the pairing due to kinetic energy, I would say that even on the stripe, maybe the pairing is produced due to the change of some board, some excitation.
Is this observation that we have a single gas and we have
I'm going to go try and find it.
And we have some kind of is the observation that we have a single gas and we have some kind of quality condensation we undergo routine. Sort of what we are also seeing in the R-Fed data, like there are arcs and Fermi arcs, and so you have low energy excitation.
And we see versus EDC curves.
And then there are the
it's seen in an insulator. The same Fermi arc is seen in an insulator, 3% LSCO. So please be careful in what you call quasi-particles.
We don't call those insulators.
Well, they're not Fermi liquids.
Yeah, that's true.
Let's put it that way.
Would it be good to write the categories that we're discussing here on the board?
Okay, all right. So what do you do? Basically, we have a board of liquids. And then we have strong relations and whatever it is. What else is there?
I think the transport properties of
the kinetic energy of the Okay, so basically I would say that we all agree on this. It's good to start with low stream later.
Fractionalization.
Sasha, I think the very important point that we should probably talk about whether we agree on or not is this a doped mock insulator? Is the are the experiments telling us this has something to do with being close to a mock insulator or not? The strong coupling, the weak coupling, we can distinguish it by whether you produce the signatures of a doped Mott insulator or not, right? Superfluid density being proportional to doping tells us this is probably a doped Mott insulator physics. Whereas the I think that is really the key question.
My drive here, my topic here,
what drives pairing most of the criteria. So,
well, you can't.
But this goes, this
those
this
goes
cuts
exactly
to the nature of
the nature
of the normal state.
Exactly.
This is also the question of what the model is.
Exactly. You've got to categorize the model.
So you want me to put it here? It's not around the
meta. I think we can put it here.
It's a meta question.
Does anybody disagree?
We're starting with the right model.
You will agree if you have that part of the physics in it, or it doesn't.
Because I think joke, mock, and failure is something I would think it is. Check, right?
Yeah, mock insulator. Yeah.
Well, if it's a dope mock insulator, then if you check that, you're going to have to go with strong coupling approach.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so okay. No, the question.
Where has this been dropped out?
Yeah.
If there is a weak coupling, you can start with weak coupling approach.
I'm not saying you can, but you already said you could not.
So, this is not such a stupid question, actually. We know that we can arrive at this board, not from here, but from here.
Yeah, sure.
So why this is a starting low ground, this is a novel, very important, is a real grand challenge. And if I count 100 Kelvin from the liquid bizarres, suddenly it's a no.
It comes from the liquid, but then you're not addressing the anecdotal regions.
Is it somehow the language in which we're trying to describe it with the underlying physics? I mean, there are presumably whatever the
model
is, there are many languages in which we're trying to describe it.
Okay, I plan to shrink the discussion at some point, the discussion of the boredom and the features, and tell you more about molecular coupling. We can bend out here all the possibilities, etc. And I agree that discussing it, whether it's more insulator or not, is different from discussing what's right here. I mean, it's related, but I don't know. Definitely.
I couldn't find Matthew or Leon, unfortunately. And you may have asked this while I was gone, but I have been interested in whether one believes that as one moves around here, one can go from weak to strong coupling without passing through a critical point, or whether it's a crossover. Since if it's a crossover, it seems to me then where some of us who would like to work on the far side and get an explanation there have a shot at it. But if as you run along this thing, you hit a
different
critical point of some kind where the theory fundamentally changes, then we're going to suffer.
Do you
mean
about the experimental status of that
stress? Yeah, well, there's an experiment. If you think about the, if we agree that there is a QCP,
No.
Okay, so we can talk about the
problem. Do we agree that there is none?
And in what sense do we have a point of view there? As an interesting object to study?
No, it's not really the electron, though.
But you might be playing the game.
Yeah. This thing here.
If the enable the whole dome to be there. Right?
That's the question.
And what maybe it doesn't enable? Maybe it's just there. You know, it has nothing to do with it, but it's still there.
Will you worry about some critical point being out here? So we're only paying attention to this critical point. And that's because this will definitely be receiving high temperature, right?
No, but that's the ground state. But that's for some reason, the ground state, which is on the right, is different from the ground state, which is on the left, for whatever reason. All the approaches you developed on one side are likely to fail on the other side, or at least you have to modify them.
But at least we can be reasonably comfortable. You know, actually, they say the domain of applicability of the law ranges a little bit longer than you really naively would expect. So the same
here. Yeah, sure, there is a mix-up stuff going on here. But, if you arrive from here, maybe you're not making that much of a mistake.
Right, so naively, you would expect that crossover it stops working. Now it stops working where this board is divided, because that's where you put your QCP. So this is somewhat a question of numbers and not the fundamental question.
So my question here is actually, we pull in QCP. I have my opinion. I'm just trying to clarify why you suggested it. Is it because it's important for mechanism, or is it because it's important because it's there?
It's important for the freshening of the mechanism. If you want to consider strong coupling and weak coupling as two different forms of the mechanism.
So maybe there is a certain possibility that weak coupling and strong coupling have nothing to do with it. It's only one critical point, and so a break or a critical point.
But I think it's in a weaker sense that one worries about it, in the sense that maybe it's because I worry about it because maybe one gets some sort of satisfaction of an explanation, say, for Hubbard model with
I don't know, U over TU 4 or 6 or 8, and thinks one understands the whole problem, but in fact what's going on is when you get bigger, there's a critical point at which the basic picture of what's happened switches completely, and therefore the correct physics coming off model is very different than that. My question is that if that's a sharp change of some kind, then if it's some more gradual one, then it seems to me we could live with our understanding coming from either side.
Bill, yeah.
I would say in the TJ model, there's absolutely no evidence for quantum gravity. My reasoning for that has to do with the data I presented yesterday, the temperature dependence of the pairing correlation lines. As you go down in temperature and the correlation line grows, it's also shifting in doping. It shifts into smaller doping. So this is not just simply growing at a single doping point.
What's the fundamental situation?
Well, these are right there.
Just a comment related to the quantum critical point. The aspect which bothers me most about the spin fluctuation notion is the lack of that approach to understand the linear resistivity as much as that exists in the optimum dope system. So for many.
So the standard, like Planck, whatever.
I don't know.
Or RVB, because I don't know, if you start doing gauge shields, isn't it true that in terms of fluctuation of the gauge shields, early on people explain very easily temperature because of the
cut time. The is people that earlier claimed they get a linear resistivity. I have not been convinced by either of those calculations. But I spent quite some time trying to, I don't think that there's a reliable explanation for the linear resistivity assumption temperature. And it's just, what among all these, many of these properties we can probably declare, maybe it's just a mess. It's an ethical number, it's in addition to there are competing phases, they don't matter. But maybe I'm misguided, but I think this transport properties is a repeating phenomenon that occurs here and in a variety of material. It goes to rather low temperatures, formals don't seem to explain it. And this is what worries me most about this, the description that one, that this very harmonic point of view, well, maybe we could meet each other in the middle at some point, and nature's not allowed.
So Anderson, big fat idea.
Well, but if the middle happens to be a point where neither point of view is actually applicable, you could imagine that no one's even done the calculation yet.
Right.
Possibly. It's not very satisfying. So the one sort of literature that I'm not familiar with is this infermion approach, which we love this in the And there is, you find that the quasi particles become not quasi particles and progressively lower and lower energies, and eventually get a critical point where they're just not quasi particles. I was wondering if somebody would like to sort of critique this. I'm not in a position to do that, and talk about how you get around this if you accept some kind of spin fluctuation. I mean, is this representative of spin fluctuation theories of the body, or is this a particular spin fermion model that gives you this kind of behavior? It seems like it's fairly generic result to me. The fact that at some point, somewhere under that dome, you run out of quasi particles and the whole spin fluctuation picture is supposed to fit.
Most of your theory is completely ignored if you're hitting a muffin.
Oh, I think it fails long before you get there. Doesn't it fail somewhere in the middle of the...
In what sense do you mean?
Fail in the sense that there's no quasi particles left and the whole spin fermion approach is supposed to break down.
I'm not sure what you mean by no quasi particles left.
That they're not, I mean, in the sense...
Maybe what normal?
I think the point of the spin fermion approach, as Chubukov, Abanov, Shmalian, is that actually even though there are no long-lived quasi-particles in the normal state, you can still pair them to get the superconducting state, right?
Yeah.
Which is a strong coupling version of the Lagrange
curve. Okay.
Did you mean the homogeneous bosonic field there, or did you include an atomic scale special boson?
Here?
Yeah.
Boson?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, this is actually very general. We don't have to be boron, we don't have to be like in the paramagnetic or whatever. What I mean by this is, yeah, including local, including standard.
I just want, because we know that, for instance, I can imagine that in John's stripe and Steve's picture, we have stripe, but basically we can't do it because there is some tendency for the gas to go together. And then however they rearrange themselves, it's a sort of extrinsic to this issue. But the pair is given further.
Can I make a comment with this thing? Get everybody mad.
Okay.
We could have had the same discussion in 10, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially the same list would be on
no.
the board.
No.
I think it's actually the same as we're doing. And I think it's important to remember that there are examples out there of strong coupling systems which are very hard to solve.
Yes.
Which people now believe that they understand, they really know this very well, where nobody ever understood what the pair mechanism was exactly.
Yeah.
It's quantitative sense, and it's a union tree. And there is no real understanding of what the boson and what the blue is. Okay?
No, there
is no, well, there is no stabilization on the mind. What I can talk to myself, the stabilization of particle phase is due to some paramagnet, right? But the direction.
No, it's not true. It's part of the interaction.
The primary driver, the primary glue is actually some correlation effect.
Yeah.
Stabilizing A versus B in all these exotic phases is actually you have to do the correction.
There's no feedback. You started out with the Macmillan Rowell. There's no analog of the Macmillan Rowell for bringing these things. And yet we think we understand it because we have a description, a phenomenological description which works pretty well, very well in fact, in each phase. And we know what the structure of the phase diagram is. Mm-hmm. So maybe at the end of the day we're going to have to be successful with that.
That's a green possibility, but I guess so. Okay, so
this PC is too high to ignore that.
Just one underlying thing I think it's worth keeping in mind is what's special about the cuprates? Well, TC is unusual in these materials, and they're unusual among transition metal oxides. And so it seems that there ought to be something about the material that makes them different. So in discussing mechanisms, it seems that...
So you're saying that logically, because it's so different, something else has to be not just a standard for taking out the old Macmillan Rowell that you brought yourself and apply here. Something new should be as
well,
right?
Well, it's worth keeping in mind.
Well, I'd like to do exactly opposite. I'd like to drive it back to boson.
But John, what if you were to say one of the differences is the level of energy involved, the J compared with phonon energies in lead?
I would agree, but I would say that's coming from the mod insulator, and so that if you want to understand that, you need to think about the dope mod insulator rather than coming from the right hand side. But that's my
own. So let me show you now the subsection. I understand this is a very diverse way. I want to talk about boson, and I want to talk more about the interacting time to processes as a new way of interrogating the system. So what we see is actually over the years, again,
to a large extent, all of the exotic phases disappear because we see quasi polygon coherence. This is actually the phenomena that's now verified by artists and verified by STM. So, again, I'm saying that the more conventional sort of concept seems to sort of gaining domain basically in the high-DC explanation or mechanism. So at least, look, I don't know. Let me go this way. I cannot tell you yes or no. Let's go there. Okay, just like Nandini was saying, that we can take this variational approach, see what it gets us, what the result will be. And then we'll see if that makes sense. So look, I just want to give you some examples of inelastic scattering that shows up regardless of what the reference state is. And I can do it on the blackboard. Doug will obviously tell us more. So the quest is actually look at the combined essentially momentum resolution that Shamus can offer us with energy resolution we can see in this cycle. So now we can do it, and then artists presumably will follow also the thermoelastic analysis. What are the properties of the bosons one look at? What are their energies? What are the typical ray vectors? This is again oversimplification. This ray vector, I mean, these bosons can live in the whole brilliant zone with different intensities. But basically, crudely, we work, if it's true that there is a glue of some sort, local extended in the form of a boson, there are very few basic features we want to extract from the outset. After all, this 5-pi spin one resonance offered us exactly this very nice, simple package about the thing in density rising up below TC, very consistent with the TC temperature, with the intensity. So intensity of the resonance peak at 5-pi was rising very consistently with a simple mean field theory. So it didn't work out, I believe, for spin one resonance.
Sorry, good question. Wasn't it true, at least in some of this simple spin resonance peak analysis, there was an argument that yes, there is a peak that appears below TC. However, a large fraction of the spectral wave mediated pairing is in this flat part, which is
featureless background. Exactly.
It's fairly featureless, and that would be hard to see as a boson, right?
No,
we might just have sort of a very flat background with some cutoff at high energy, and I tried to do Macmillan-Rao.
Well, you still can do it.
But what would you see?
You get alpha squared F, which would be pretty broad.
But, okay, and then on that background, you would put one.
You're saying that wouldn't see anything, right? Or artists wouldn't see anything.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
But it's a fact, if you take, for example, theories like McNorman's or Chubukov's for this resonance mode, that within those theories, the resonant portion is not causing the pairing. But it is a side effect. So it is an illusion to extract just that boson and take only that as the alpha square and get a TC, which is 5 millikelvin, and then ruin that theory. It would just be the wrong logic.
I would say that this was exactly the logic of Wenner, and Dan was also involved in this.
But what you just said is exactly, regardless of who was doing it, you just said it exactly right. I think the intensity under this is, I don't know, about 3% of the sum rule, and if you ever put it into standard Heliosberg, you find that it does just nothing for the TC, and so it's all coming from elsewhere, regardless of what any of us did in the past. Sure, I remember all of that, but because I was only doing some of it. But what you said is right.
I agree with you, but I think actually the people who sold or bought this idea precisely because of the simplicity, because intensity was rising below TC, etc. That's what got attention. So, yeah. So, but you're right, that actually more realistic theory should include the whole interference background.
It's not only good, it's useless to do that. You rule, whatever you get, you have nothing you can conclude from that.
Okay, right? I'm sorry, but...
So my only point on this, quote-unquote page, would be that I want to do the alpha squared F of Q and omega. Namely, I want to get the spectroscopy of where the thing's happening in Q and omega. Should it happen that it's featureless, I don't see it.
We might still see it.
Shemo sees something, like Arpis probably in the inelastic channel might see something as well, I don't know. So without trying it, it would be foolish not to do it. I mean, without trying, how you tell it's failed a priori. Maybe there are some, yes, Peter.
I have a question about your parameters for the search. It is really directed above because I was kind of perturbed by the discussion description of why it has a peak at this particular shape. And this particular shape is actually what's underlying the analysis that Seamus is doing right now. It's in D2i squared.
Yes.
So my question to you, Doug, is that particular form of delta 1 and delta 2 that you had in the old days, was that dependent on details in any sense of the boson spectrum, or on characteristics of those two functions in omega based entirely on analytic properties?
No, I think. Let me draw a little better, because although as you know we've had some severe differences over the years, my first paper I wrote with Bill Anderson, what we looked at were details. And the details were this. This thing starts off and has, I forget how it works, it has air van home. In the phonon density space, there's a longitude, there's transverse, there's longitudinal. But there are van Hove singularities in the 3D system, as you know. Okay. The first paper had to do with looking over here to see if we could pick up van Hove singularities. And so it's very detailed, and all I showed was a simple model. I showed you just the transverse one, the creeper looking by model one, back from the neutron data. We could neutron data and model it. But of course, what really happens is you come down, you have this, and then you come down, and you have this. And this you tend to associate either with longitudinal and this with transverse. But these aren't just one mode. These are the whole neutron spectrum.
Yeah.
So maybe that's not what you're asking.
What I'm asking is, could I imagine that I had a different system? I thought this was the way. In a different superconductor, is it possible that delta 1 doesn't have that crashing dip right there? It has it somewhere else, and so things conspire so that you actually get a broad peak as a result of phonons.
We have to bring over a few from McMillan and Rowell.
There's mercury,
there's indium, there's all sorts of different shapes, and when they deconvoluted them, they found quite remarkable shapes that then eventually looked like neutron, looked a lot like neutron scattering off powder samples, but you have to remember there's alpha squared, as you know, alpha squared alpha omega. The alpha squared is a coupling. And if the coupling were much stronger in certain modes, then it would warp what they pulled out compared with the neutron scattering, because neutron scattering was just alpha omega, and you needed the coupling.
Again, this slide actually, what Doug was saying about McMillan-Rowell. Is it possible that you have turned on?
Oh, useful slide or this thing?
No, I have the computer. I just want to show this.
Here, I'm not sure what you were asking. Well, the question is, Jonas is optimizing his procedure to look for peaks in E2i dB squared, and I'm wondering if the procedure is necessarily going to pick up when it's designed to pick up.
Peter.
The structures.
On this question.
Yeah.
I believe I have to add something to this. Right. And this is something that is quite universal, and it works not only for superconducting case, where you don't have to worry about the measurement part of it yet. The features.
Yeah.
So here it is. Just
what Dad was saying, this is a Nasco stage from the Azo paper. This is the omega minus delta minus omega no kettle. But there's one form of the series. Exactly as that was showing the maximum delivery right here in the second delivery. And again, that was saying that there are two different samples, one is red, one is the indium. And you have two peaks. And these two peaks correspond to the step up and step down in the tunnel for the conductor.
And you can see the Van Hove in three dimensions, the Van Hove singularities, which in this case. changing in slope, and so you are picking up a lot of, they pick up a lot of detail. What we really need, what's shown is, I think that's Gieber's early work at the top. If we had a blow up of Rowell McMillan, and then we had a blow up of what they found for delta, real imaginary and Z, which are all in, I don't know, parts of the book or in their long article. But you would get a more definite answer, particularly if you looked at mercury, which has a huge peak at low frequency, and you look at indium, which is somewhere else, as to what you would try and look at now if you were going back into it and said, all I can see are the peaks. Sort of what I tried to show on the left is, if you really were just looking at, it depends what derivative you take. You're taking one more derivative of the IDB, then in fact, where that very sudden drop down is, you'd see as a sharp negative piece. Am I making any sense of it? And that's what Rowell McMillan did. They pull out the second IDB squared in some of their stuff, and you see extremely sharp structure there. And you could sort of identify that, perhaps, as associated with the
form. Yeah. your phonon, you know, what this is representing as well, is the phonon that comes up and gets very flat near the zone boundary, and the transverse one gets very flat because there's a lot of phase space on the pile of stuff.
So let me give a little bit sort of like on the background here.
Are you talking?
No, not quite. I want to say that actually, again, Dac was among the first ones to look at this data. You know, why second derivative, even though this is not.
Why second derivative? Because basically
the
way to amplify the diffusion in that case. Whether there is a proper Feynman diagram to that or not, that's probably difficult to relate to simple sort of Feynman diagram. But the idea was that actually back in the 60s, they looked at the metal, oxide metal coming with some molecules, the atomic molecules sitting in the gap. And another PWD and the CD peaks had the energy corresponding for the old what was energy, was energy for the molecules. So, to me, basically, what I would want you to give is like a couple of examples of why it works and where it works, regardless of whether it's the conducting one, and actually,
there is no fucking morality for this system. But nevertheless, in the last 64, it works. Frankly, it works because it's sort of bust because it's just nothing more but the you get second order perturbations here. It's energy conservation in the scattering. That's why it's sort of bust. So, this is one example. Then this is an example of
the statement that there is no McMillan Ravel mean this change. If I take the bosonic mode coupled to an electronic bus, do you call it McMillan Ravel, or do you call McMillan Ravel something which related to the algorithm?
Well, maybe in this sense I'm calling it. So McMillan Ravel, there are many things. There is atmosphere where they have, obviously there is atmosphere where they have some sort here, but there is no real measuring part of the gap. Yeah, in this sense there is no McMillan Ravel, yeah.
Okay.
You asked me, I answered.
Okay.
So then actually the similar quest for local torque in elastic time and spectroscopy was first accomplished by there's a whole head-on channel to show that one.
So that just speaks again, the same idea. You look at the second video. Why?
So here is a very simple torque calculation.
So we take a simple like Bohmann is for incident here with 3,000 K and instead of locally electric towards the side, it's up to 1,000 K. Then we can show that the correction density of state for the local process are nothing more but the second order, nothing more than the bare density of state shifted to the right by the energy of the moon. This is the thermal working function.
Sasha?
Yeah.
So would this be true in the normal state of the Cooper?
Yes. It will be 22 again, say. Okay, so my mark drive is actually what happens is in elastic spectroscopy, it creates an elastic satellite. If you happen to have a sharp feature in density of state, you will have a sharp and elastic satellite. If you don't have a sharp feature, you might not be elastic. Okay.
Just in response to Kenneth's question, I think what Sasha is saying is this would be true in the normal state if you had a simple normal tunnel junction. You put an impurity somehow on the top or in the oxide layer so that it acts through the tunneling. If, on the other hand, we all know if you go in the normal state and you got the impurity laying in the metal, then unfortunately you don't pick up the signal. You have to go superconducting before you see
signal. No.
That's
right. The reason why you didn't see it in the 66 was because you averaged over all of it. Each single guy will produce through that.
Even if it's in the metal.
Yeah.
Deep in the metal.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's interesting.
Just like what my promise is extending for del base for elastic scattering. That's inelastic for del base, actually. You see them?
The reason that is the surface.
The reason you didn't pick it up, I have a hidden slide here. It was your theory.
I'll let it go.
You want me to bring it up?
I don't think everyone's so interested in it.
That calculated this thing conductance for the planar tunneling. And if you assume the sub-energy is only energy dependent, then we know that there is no density of state normalization. The reason there is no momentum dependence to sub-energy was because you take different sites, all kind of with different phases, with the Friedel ripples. By the time you average, you get zero contribution. in the nitride UV spray. If you take one in the metal, it doesn't have to be in the junction. If you take one impurity inside the metal, in fact, I'll show you. You will get it.
Could you show data?
Yeah, I'll show data. So my only point about the question, I'm not giving it to
you.
No, I'm not giving it to you. I'm giving
examples. Okay.
I can raise a screen and give examples on the blackboard.
Right.
Would you believe me? We can do it this way. I don't have to do the blackboard. You prefer the blackboard.
I'm just saying the talk is defined by what you do, not how you do it.
All right, yeah, exactly. Don't believe what you really hear. So the story is that the only lesson actually we drew from this one was that the reason we're getting the step up, which results in the second derivative peak, is that we take a bare density of states. Take a bare density of states. It's metallic density of states. To lead, I have to add density of state shifted to the right and multiplied by coupling constant squared. So for this one, I have to add another function that looks like this. And what I'll get is this. Is this right? Of course it's not, because it doesn't preserve the spectral wave. Is this right as a guidance about where singularity will be? Yes. Right? So this is a double. About W, we don't care what's going on, because there is a lot of things will happen there. But as far as the step up in density of states, it will happen in the right place as far as the energy comes. So, question?
So essentially, to get this first step, you take the lower edge of the band and
no.
You shift it. No. Where does the step come from?
Because it's a theta function.
Ah, so it comes. So it's Fermi circuit.
Now I'm confused.
Well, we can do the math at the blackboard later, but the thing is actually, let me show you something else here. Imagine I have a semiconductor with a very wide band, and I have a narrow impurity band there. Okay, so here's my impurity, here's my accommodating well. Imagine I'm coming with the STM peak with the chemical potential, and it's slightly higher than the level. And so when I'm overshooting, I wouldn't be so able to tunnel in, unless I happen to be in the vicinity of this inelastic object. So I can shed off excess energy and fall down here.
So the Boolean function of energy has a very sharp feature. Your original thing was one level, it was delta function of energy.
Yes.
Imagine I have a flat band with some boundaries, right?
Yes.
Featureless. So what I'm asking is, at what point, so you're tunneling and you can tunnel and tunnel and tunnel, and then when you reach some energy, you have a step.
Yes.
Right? And this is energy just corresponding to your bosonic mode, or?
Or flat featureless density state.
That precisely in that picture, I don't understand, because I still don't imagine starts broadening this thing in the band. I need to tunnel somewhere above the band to make your picture work, no?
You may want to make it take Gibson or Lorentzian tail.
No, anyway, just the box.
The rest is the box. Now, the box I showed you.
Well,
here's the formula. Take the box, shift it to the right, and turn it on after the threshold area for the parameters. Well, what I'm describing is
actually, if you take the box and shift it to the right by the boson energy, what you're doing really, you're shifting the...
No, forget about negative side. Forget about negative side. Take initial area. Take density of state. Okay.
Take positive density of state from here. Shift it to the right. Why do you take only positive? I think that's what I'm confused about. Why am I taking only positive one?
Because that's how it works out when you do the self turning to that, yeah.
Okay, that you have to show.
Yes, I have to show. Because basically you have to have excess energy. It only works for positive energy, basically. If you have a fully filled thermal surface.
And the theta function from the Fermi surface comes. Excellent.
So my point is, if I have a flat, let's just say I have a step up, which I can amplify by taking a second derivative. If I have a peak, I will have inelastic satellite you see, which is called Stokes satellite, which in disguise is nothing more but, again, this inelastic satellite. So if I'm overshooting with this energy, basically, I can get rid of excess energy and fall here, which means if I have a peak here of strength 1, well, of course, the strength of the peak here will be equal. And then I can really get more fancy about the temperature dependencies. And there is, of course, anti-Stokes satellite, but the low temperature is very small.
Right, so the way I do it, or the way I rationalize it, if you think of here assuming I'm not there, what we have a sharp peak at the places where we do have a sharp peak. And then I don't essentially flood that space. So let me simplify. Let me say that I have a sharp peak here, which is coherent peak and flood the diagnostic space up here. Why? Because we know the energies of the modes we're looking at is about 50 to 70 millivolts. So by the time you hit 70 millivolts, you're way out there, you don't worry about the dying tail of the coherent peak. And so if you believe, so in this very simple picture that I have a flat background and a sharp peak here, where the feature will be, due to an elastic scattering. Again, one local mode that could have here is something that in the presence of one ball in the spring where I get something about local problem. Where the will be the other possibility?
So the feature, so the width of the feature is given by what?
By temperature is given by the
precise shape of the feet. Given by the precise spectral function for the boson at the time.
So in a way, so in the tau case, you should get a peak, right? So in this reading back to the universe, this real imaginary stuff, you get the, this direction.
There is no imaginary stuff in this one. I just look at the real one.
So this is a real light bulb, this absorption shape comes from the real imaginary function.
Exactly. So my only point is actually the place where the feature will be
second peak, which will show up as a large peak in the universe, will be at another possibility.
Right, but experimentally we see there is just a dip and a peak, right? So which is nothing.
Oh, there is. Oh,
this is actually here. This is nothing like a real calculation. I'll show you the real thing.
So how do we relate this to these ground?
Well, can you see?
I mean, the okay. Summary showed that there is a dip and that there is a peak and there is this hump. So I mean, what was the one?
So perhaps I should show you a real calculation for the
earth. Can I sharpen up this question?
Yes, okay.
So there is the shape of this widow is similar to what Doug drew on the board. However,
this is actually my PowerPoint wiggle. It's not a real wiggle.
However, I think because of the different physical origin, it's not obvious that the position of the peak or the inflection point or something else corresponds to the actual boson energy.
Okay. So let me show you the calculation.
Okay. The calculation will not have real imaginary part of the graph, though. It will be still a D wave, yeah.
It will be still a D wave, yeah. No imaginary part. That's right. There will be no retardation in the calculation. Yes.
Okay.
But basically, it will be exactly the place of delta plus omega in the derivative. You're right. So for the calculation for the real, for both the real and imaginary part, has not been done. I just want to show that actually, on this one, this is data. Don't pay attention to this.
This is a part of different plot, but there are molecular junctions. So people look at the molecular crystal sitting in the junction, and they can manufacture them, so there is a current going through the cage where there is a spin. So this molecule itself is very soft. It has low lying quantum mode, about 20 millivolts. And totally there is a quantum effect going on. But the spin is a great game of spin. So what they show here is the data from Doug Nettleton, which is published in Seattle. So there is a quantum peak here, and there are inelastic satellites to the quantum peak. So they're displaced exactly by the quantum mode, or vibrational mode. And so the point actually is that in the deep inside this inelastic spectroscopy is the energy conservation. That's why it's robust. You've seen it in the junction, you've seen it in the quantum dots, you've seen it in the molecular junctions, you see it in superconductors. It's because of the second order essentially perturbation theory, nothing more works. I mean, a lot is explained by just looking at the energy conservation. So if you look at the charge spin separated from the system, the single constraints, kinematic constraints about how much of the spin and pollen you can afford from scattering of neutrons will be stayed exactly the same. You have to have to accommodate the energy of incoming excitation.
So Adam's explanation earlier today contradicts that statement.
You have to do which one?
But he explained that if there is a mode, it will have an effect on the real and imaginary part of the self energy.
Yes.
And then because of how they're used together to go into the spectral function, the mode doesn't. the signature of the mode is at the minimum of AK of omega, which in terms, which would contribute this to
the mode. This is not a proposal, this is data, right?
So I understand, but I'm confused by the different pictures.
So I think actually it's the same story if I put the imaginary part of delta here. You know, for the lifetime, something else might be happening. I don't know exactly what it is.
I see. So that's the potential explanation for the
week. Yeah, because I think actually, let me show you this simple calculation we did, and then we can go on to. Yeah, so here it is. So there's a helix significant damper with one boson, local boson motion, and six is energy only one. So first of all, the same rule of thumb will tell you that. At the quality we have a linear floating density, so there will be two. Because we have one floating linear function, we have to add another one, offset by energy of the mass. So inside the gap, there's always a king ceiling, which actually tells you where the energy of the mass is. But because we have so few density states here, that we say to work with, the feature is small. The strongest one always shows up outside of the gap, and it's consistent with this, so basically, somebody was asking whether it's a deep or a deep. So there is a deep here. This is a real delta calculation. There is no imaginary part. But this looks pretty similar to what the other thing you will get.
Is this for a tau 0 or a tau 3 or a tau 1 contribution to self-energy?
This is happening to local basically oscillators.
But is this happening?
So it's a tau 3. It's a tau 3, but it's. How you say it. The local density happens to the harmonic oscillator. So it's tau 3.
Did your calculations, I mean, would you be able to distinguish between an anomalous term in self-energy versus a diagonal term in self-energy?
Yeah. So this is actually tau 1. Okay.
Do you think you can tell if you were fighting with really heading? These are very similar, just the end.
Sure.
Right. But it's very similar to what we've seen a number of years back.
No, it's somewhat different.
What is the different part of this?
So there are two purposes. There are two main goals. One is to make sure for the people that there are other inelastic experiments going on there.
Great.
And they all show this.
Okay, great.
And wait. Yes, now I'm talking. Okay. Plus, it's my session. So my point is actually that when people talk about Eliasberg, Macmillan, Rowell, etc., this is very important, but there is this like underlying much more powerful thesis going on about the energy conservation. That's what leads to the features of that sort of thing.
I hate to bring up this point again, but I think the main difference between what you told us and what we heard before is that if you do a self-consistent calculation within Eliasberg, delta 1 and delta 2 change around the phonon frequency, and that what gives you the shape.
Yeah. Right. I fully agree with you.
Okay.
My point is actually the shape in the purely real delta 1 looks very similar to the shape calculated for Eliasberg. But there is a large negative peak at energy delta plus omega naught for this self-consistent calculation, but only in the real part. So I'm taking some comfort in this term.
Can I ask you one question about your coupling? I realize you're coupling to some an oscillator or whatever this may be that vibrates. But do the Fermi operators remove a fermion from one side of the tunnel of the junction and put it in the other? Or is this all happening in the same material?
It's the same material. There is no tunnel junction.
Okay, thank you.
So where I'm going ultimately is actually I can do the tau 3 in elastic scattering or I can do tau 1 in elastic scattering. And this is more technical side, but the idea would be now, if we can follow this feature as a function of position and do Fourier transform, so that's what the channels will do. He's offsetting this. It's complicated by the fact that the gap is actually in the sample is different. But he's offsetting his measurement by subtracting delta and doing Fourier transform in the second degree. So essentially the proposal was that we looked first at 5 pi resonance mode. Because we also thought that this is so ubiquitous that it should be seen in the inelastic time spectroscopy. There's a paper where we suggested this inelastic time spectroscopy for your transform as a means of getting after not only energy of this mode, bosonic mode, but also at the wave vector. And something worked out, and the fissure was close to pi phi at the right energy. So unfortunately, actually, it's not what Shamov sees. So what I mean, so let me just show you the problem. Yeah? I don't know. So the proposal is that actually we take
with a simple bosonic drug.
So right now I have a sort of boson living everywhere. We have one here.
Why? Because if I do Fourier transform, and if I have a some torsional invariant system with boson, so on, if I do by the time I do Fourier transform, everything falls to the gamma point and there is nothing else. But all the gathers is actually together solution, working, but working in the elastic channel. And so basically we take an appliance, take it to a pairing, take the theory potential by any other collecting mode. This is an example of the idea for the team collecting mode. We do the crank about the team matrix, self-consistent calculation with self-energies. And in it, this is actually might be sort of relevant for your question. This is a strong coupling calculation. So far I was giving just a handwriting examples about how to do this energy coupling. You can do a real calculation in terms of strong coupling. It's the in field or the strong coupling.
Well, this has no cover of you anywhere. Right?
Yes, it's strong coupling. It's a strong coupling to the impurity mode.
There is a strong coupling to Hubbard, there is a strong coupling between electron and boson. In the Eliasberg language.
So
it's not semantic. It's exactly what happened to these people, basically. Strong coupling in the context of superconductivity, like you can do the Eliasberg for MacMillan-Rao, means that the coupling to the phonon is strong enough that the phonon features modify electronic spectrum. So this is a strong coupling in this sense, but not in the sense of you. And then what we have is this one.
If you go along any model point, it's a one-down model. So there's deep coherence peaks and they are sort of asymmetric because there is one portion of the energy on one side. So it pulls out the spectral wave on any side in this case. And then you turn on the coupling to 0, 1, 2, 3, and you can see that there is growth of inelastic satellites at the expense of the main peak. So in this sense, there's no coupling problem. So there's all the points where you fight off, but we do see the electric satellite growing in exactly the place where the energy comes, which tells me they should.
There's very large peak in the coherence peaks at delta in the view of the conductor. So it produces satellite. By the time you average over all angles, you're getting some emissions asymmetric. It's more like a plus side peak on the impurity side. I'm sorry, no impurity. This is like a full completion invariant system. So that's what we get. But the drawback of the propulsion and variant system is this pattern will be the same everywhere. So it doesn't make sense to do the Fourier transform.
Do you have a well-defined Einstein mode there, or do you have any?
Okay, in this case it was a pi-pi mode at a delta function essentially. Sorry, slightly broad delta function peak at pi-pi. This energy.
Yeah.
Well, we have to do the calculation, and I'm going to show you just some of the intensity plots. We can talk more at the blackboard later. Yes, we do have calculations. We have calculations for tau 3 and for tau 1.
But if you smear it, if you broaden your mode, that's what goes.
Yeah, if you broaden your mode, it's
this feature will get smeared.
But the fact that you have a dip and a peak, is that how robust is that? Obviously, you have a feature.
I think
a little band structure or something like that.
I think it's related to the position of the Van't Hoff. Van't Hoff is sitting around here.
Yeah.
So if I flip it, it will change the size. So it's somewhat similar to what.
Before was important in a different context. And then you need to put impurity in, you start seeing something.
So this is an impurity resonance, and this is an inelastic satellite from the positive and negative bias on the impurity side. You move like one side way up into the right, you start seeing these things are getting alive, so they start moving. And that's what I call the inelastic fidelity one. So this is impurity sitting here, this is impurity tails, and then you see some standing wave ripple at the inelastic channel. So if I flip this picture and put it aside, so this is impurity side, and then you see this actually L, which is only pronounced when you have the resonant emission. So in this case, it was negative only by delta plus 1 to the It requires additional momentum because it was not there, and it's not there in the web.
Now, so what happened was actually we looked at a small size system. In this case, if you put a transform, put it right metal quite fast. So we thought this was right. This worked. And it turns out it's not. This is exactly the same region as what Adam was seeing. So if you do it right, you always start getting a lot of this. This is a Tower 3 scan. We start getting a lot of this spectral plot. There are regions run by far, there's a diamond coming from the next system. And so we don't have a full inversion procedure to take Shemus's data for the Fourier transform and tell you where the peaks are. We are not at this level of sophistication, but what we can do is actually we can show the catalog of possibilities. We take particular boson mode, we fit it in the presence of disorder, so we can share the disorder. And we can tell what the Fourier transform will look like. I wouldn't know without doing it. So basically, this is the obvious next step. Well, I think it's not very complicated because Macmillan-Raoult, what it does in a mathematical sense, is just numerical inversion of some integral in frequency. Either you have alpha squared f of omega, you put it in, you turn the crank, you find delta of omega, or vice versa. From Tannenegg, you measure delta of omega, and you calculate alpha squared of omega. So basically, before in the 60s, people were inverting only one frequency integral. Now we want to do this actually not only in frequency but in QT, along the Q space as well. Conceptually, it's absolutely the same to me, basically. There is no fundamental difficulty. The problem with inversion would be, as any inversion procedure, it's inherently ill-defined. Unless we agree on the input, we won't agree on the outputs of this inversion. So what I mean by that, actually. So, okay, there are two things.
As far as the inversion procedure and why it's still defined, we only see some features in the energy, right? And the
maybe
I'll show you.
Why don't I show a couple of
just trying to use these opinions?
Let me see. I will be finishing it. So just to give an example.
These are some calculations for the Fourier transform and elastic for tau 3 and the sweep energy. And the resonance energy here, for instance, 36 plus 40 millivolts is 76 millivolts. And there is something going on there, basically, but the main juice, the main action is happening around the sweep. That's what happens with tau 3. We can choose either from Devereaux coupling or we can choose the coupling gaps for accumulation tolerated. It does change a little bit the intensity.
But the drawback is that it doesn't fall onto the data, basically, of Shemus. You're struggling with data. And then we decided to do tau 1.
And in tau 1, basically, again, the same possibility. So, in other words, I'm going this route for, given these obvious suspects, I'm going forward to see what the fingerprint in the Fourier transform will be.
So
this
is
a pipeline.
Sasha, this you said tau 1, tau 3 several times, and I want to make sure that you're talking about the actual Fourier potential channel now, not the inelastic coupling.
Yes, okay, so the Hamiltonian actually, I have a standard coupling form.
Right, okay.
The tau 1 is in Fourier, tau 1 in Fourier space. So this is actually part of higher resonance, which doesn't look like something in the data. So it would be very clear, okay, there will be something in the valve point, but the intensity will be more along one direction, that's how it would look like. The better the overall intensity distributions we find are for E1G mode, because you go from here to here, don't be fooled by 0.5, this actually could be called, so this is actually about 0.23 going down, and then to about 0.01. So either B1G mode or breathing mode. So
So those are tau 1, and also interesting, like Tamar, was telling yesterday about this base efforts, etc. It's exactly the same. We were starting first and foremost in tau 3 scaling with the northern fences. On the diamond cross by pi, and there's nothing but this game too. It's because the density of phase, actually, now we have to do the G12 and G22, and there's a sign to go. So it looks pretty consistent. This curve, actually, with the error bar, shameless gap, probably will end up being consistent. This is the error bar. And so I'm just saying, actually, there is nothing wrong with going this way, actually, trying to see what the fingerprints for the collecting modes are. It would be nice to come up with the inversion procedure. And that's where we are. So it's a strong coupling, but not in the Hubbard sense.
I think strong coupling is not strong correlations.
Yeah, exactly. Different strong coupling.
It's not correlated. It's not correlated. Strongly coupled to a local model.
Yeah. We can do for any smaller system. Yeah, sure. Conceptually, there is nothing wrong with putting strong correlation in terms of U here. Of course, we wouldn't be able to do it under such a large system size, and then hence to the momentum evolution would suffer. But in terms of doing numerics like just Nandini is doing here, we don't have to do this like, yeah, I get that.
Have you
looked
at the other
Yeah, we looked at the pi. We looked at the local Einstein quantum mode, the cell one scattering. That was
security.
No, we looked at the D1G breathing and D1G and the breathing. Yeah.
But those frequencies are too high for the experiment, if I understand right. So there are other phonons.
That's right. When John was showing the one that was sitting at about 55 and YB0. You know, the flat one, he never paid attention to the low.
Because the effects are small on that compared to the breathing direction.
So obviously, yeah, for us, it's not a problem to put the proper energy in, right? So we just put in the most natural number of all the four days producer for who are these fields. Yeah.
Can you
explain
the So
I just wanted to comment on how the magnetic spectrum is treated and the current understanding of the magnetic spectrum and the Cooper breaks. So within the context of what you're doing, and I realize there was lots of emphasis in the past on resonance peak. I think it's fairly clear now that at least in YBCO and LSCO that there's the similar magnetic spectrum under there. The spectrum gets modified in the superconducting state in that the spin gap opens up and weight gets pushed up above that, and I think that's clear in the Christensen McMorrow-Epley data. So it's not that there's some mode that appears there, there's a redistribution of weight, so the magnetic excitations are being affected by the superconductivity. So just putting in the magnetic spectrum and looking at how that affects the electrons is not a self-consistent
treatment.
You have to, if you're going to deal with them, then you need to also look at what the effect of the superconductivity is on the magnetic excitations. I don't think it's, that there's not a magnetic mode that's just some benign thing that can interact, that's around, like a phonon. Phonons don't develop a gap.
Right.
The damping of the phonons can develop a gap, and does, and that's seen in niobium. But anyway, I think
your point is very well taken, John. Absolutely, I think actually for the realm of STM, like the 4 Kelvin scattering, by that time probably all the reshuffling of spectral weight is done, and you're looking at the fingerprint of this mode at this temperature range, and I don't think actually there is much left actually by the time the gap is well developed.
Right, but it's a matter of what the microscopic picture is. Because if you're interested in what pairing is, if you want to interpret what you're seeing, then I think you have to think about what kind of calculation you're doing. Because what you're seeing in the neutron scattering is the net result after the interactions take place. I think you have to consider what you're putting into your model and what it means.
Yeah, you do what you can. All right, and this is true for everybody in this room. I think just a minute. So what you're saying is absolutely so, like, would be a terrific thing to do, actually, to have a bootstrap effect on the superconductivity, on the collective mode, and to investigate the effect of both of them to see how they couple. I think actually we are not there yet. For us, basically, look, this is a mean field, obvious strong coupling, but this is a mean field G-wave calculation. So what the guidance possibly I can take from it? I can tell you, the qualitative features probably would be sort of reasonably okay. Like the intensity, the energy dependence of this bright intensity peaks in the brilliant zone, and energy. But the rest of it, actually, will depend crucially on what you're saying. So the distribution of intensity is one thing. If there is no change of the wave vector, then if I take a dump sort of mode sitting in this wave vector, not modified, I probably will see some fingerprints in the Fourier transform for an elastic at the same wave vector. But how bright it will be, there's a separate issue.
But the calculation you're referring to, at least it can be more consistent with this approach, has been done. If I look at the facts of the Eugene Vicker, where I see the resonance mode as a consequence of the feedback effect, because the opening of the gap, because of the divergence of the string there. And at the end of the day, what you see is just a forward sitting there. And that's what he's doing. I mean, I think that it's not entirely inconsistent. So again, it doesn't give you the upper threat you need for the pairing problem. That was my earlier thing, but
I just want to say that to me, algorithmically, what happens when Mahilan is coming up, what we want to do here is to get after the stochastic features of the boson. And if the boson has the sharp features, it would like to expect Q and omega. Now, any sort of bosonic sort of diagrams would involve coupling constant here, so I'm just saying that self-energies, which are coming in from the Schrödinger space, they will be dealing with the... And the same is only... Yeah, very tough. So I'm saying the following. This is what, in some direct way, is seen in SPM. So this one, if I do all what we sort of want to extract in the first step of this domain is the sky that has the omega squared minus omega or k squared. We would like to understand the dispersion in both ways. From here to here, there is a couple of additional factors. The band structure itself, which has a lot of sort of action going on in brilliant zone, depending on where you are, and the coupling time. And that's what I keep saying. This is an inversion procedure. But we need to sort of agree on what is reasonable about this, and this to assume what for us to go about the inversion. Right? Whether it's one frequency inversion or two momentum or three momentum inversions. I don't think that.
Just a relationship which popped up now with Tamara, I'm not talking new because there seems to be this how one section is going on in these materials, which I find rather spectacular. That you jump into the system and the system carries the most predominantly in adjusting its pairing potential rather than just putting some boring ordinary potential into the system.
Is it predominant with that? Yeah. My understanding from Tamara and Peter was that it's roughly the same.
Both.
It does both roughly the same.
The same order.
It does both of the same order. Yeah. Okay, so I got that wrong.
Maybe going along your same line here, but with the ARPAs, Mike Norman certainly has done this, tried to, again, extract perhaps from the structure of the ARPAs what might be the coupling function, various models we know. I think with the new generation of ARPAs experiments telling us what's happening along the nodal where kx equals ky, deep in the superconducting state where there's fair evidence that at least at low energies we have good quasi-particles in the noble region. But people are extracting MBC line widths and frequency and temperature dependence of these. And so, again, if one wants to follow the kind of procedure you're talking about, one could imagine trying to calculate those widths by calculating some self-energy and using that to try and look at, well, what do you believe an interaction would cause? Peter and I and some others, and probably many other groups have too, but we've been looking at that, trying to see if, because you're deep in the superconducting state, and you push, for one reason or another, the magnetic excitations out, you have longer lived objects, it looks like you might have quasi-particles in some region. It might be, therefore, a better region to try and play this game in, of trying to find the widths and what that is. And then you can do the one more step we spoke about, which is if you ever get this, you get a coupling constant, you go back in and see what number it gives you for the anti-modal gap. And if it gives you a half decent number there, you say, well, you completed part of the triangle Seamus talked about. And so in the spirit of your discussion, it seems to me we got STM, and as we all know, for a long time we've had ARPAs, but recently,
better ARPAs.
Recently, there's pretty spectacular ARPAs.
Isn't it true, though, that the strength of all the couplings which are being detected by these techniques are far too weak to produce 100 Kelvin
supergravity? Ah, that's what's interesting, isn't it?
So there are bosons hanging around.
Some of these bosons, the calculation I just described is surprisingly low. Shockingly low.
I see.
Yeah, this is like we got a discussion with Seamus about it. The lower the need to get a huge shocking that will make waves on paper.
Now, I think the question is, can you come off some data, particularly, say, ARPA's nodal data, looking at the on-shell elastic part. These guys will come down where kx equals ky, they go deeper and deeper and deeper into the Fermi surface, okay? And then they'll plot their MBCs, and then they'll plot you the width versus versus what they call frequency, okay? So you have that information. And then whether you are inclined to do this or not, so right now we're inclined to, you come into some formula and you put some simple form in for chi and you do this calculation and you fit your coupling constant and you do a simple job RPA or whatever you do for chi and you fit a coupling constant in there in order to give you the observed ARPAs. Then you're done. Because now you just drag that thing without any changes over, and you say, please redo the calculation, but not at the nodal point. Just redo it at the anti-nodal point, and tell me what you think the gap is. Meaning, what is the calculation thing? And you know the gap is 40 millielectron volts, and suppose you get, I don't know, 25 or 30, are you happy? Well, some of us at that level are moderately happy in the sense it's not crazy. It's not 1 or 2 millielectron volts, which wasn't here.
But in this sort of calculation, you're not attempting to identify the boson.
Well, yeah, I'm afraid we are, because what's being put in is a chi, and it's chi naught over 1 minus u chi naught. And you could say, well, let's put in a more general function. It might be nicer to call it something else, because you know it's like in the name of the rose. Remember, there were words you couldn't if you pronounced them, you would be killed. I told this to Anderson because I told him that was the way I felt about spin fluctuation. He said, no, Doug, that's the way I feel about RBB.
Doug, if I can follow up on your question, it's an interesting point because this is a case where you maybe can get enough pairing strength to explain the anti-modal gap, but there's not going to be a sharp bosonic feature in that spectrum. With enough pairing weight by itself to do that.
Oh, absolutely.
It's a broad spectrum.
Oh, yeah, this is, you've seen this. This is a horribly broad thing, and if you readjust RU from 2.2 to 2.3, you can put 3% of the weight in the nodal. I mean, you're filling with it, but whatever it is, it's terribly broad.
So is this a kinetic energy driven phase transition?
Yeah, that's an interesting question too. I don't know as we'll go down that line because it's a very good question.
I mean, what you're doing is you're gapping out spin fluctuations to higher energies.
Well,
is that where the energy saving comes from?
Oh, that's, isn't that a that's a condensation energy question you asked, and I don't know as we've done that calculation nor whether I would believe it. This is at the level of Sasha's discussion. It's not a high level.
I mean, in the spirit of Sasha's discussion,
in the spirit of this, it's not trying to say this explains everything because it doesn't have a mod aspect in it.
So I just want to make sure that, and this was, like I said, there are much broader issues. And you're trying to do the best you could what you could do as far as the boson. Other obvious no-go, other obvious reasons why this is a totally stupid idea. I just would like, maybe there is, you know, sometimes you get a referee report and says, like, this paper violates causality. And you just,
wow.
You want us to respond to your referees? You want us to respond to your referees?
There was a comment from Thomas Reuter the other day that if you look given the unique in the propagation mode, you don't know whether you should subtract the local delta or average delta over the area of the boson has been propagated.
Yes.
In order to do that.
Yeah. I don't have any immediate answer basically to that. We will just do the calculation as if it's homogeneous, but then Chambers will subtract the local value of the graph. But it's obviously an issue, and you know there are trade-offs: how far it flies, how much of a sampling it can do before it basically absorbs. You know, this is a second-order diagram.
Yeah, I would also like to understand on what level, how do you proceed with the comparison to the data? That's sort of simple.
Yeah.
What is the line
you're talking
square for this time of calculation when you come to the boson? Because if you remember from the data, the structure in the second derivative is coming from the vicinity of the derivative. The Gaussian peak is not there, there's nothing.
No, the second peak comes in the reflection of the coherence peak. Coherence peak produced in what I call an elastic start line. So the descendant of this one is an elastic scatter.
From your calculation, this where I am, this where E to I.
Oh, well, for the local mode, it was pretty clear. For the local mode, I showed you the...
Then here was the boson calculation, right? You start with the boson model.
So for the local mode, it's pretty clear.
So the W1 is talking about the impurity, O1
of W1. OK, so... You're asking how the D2I initial look like? It will look like, basically, like you should get a big peak at the coherence values,
yes.
And then there is a second peak at the delta plus omega.
Good, but the structure and Chambers data is in the second derivative is coming from the near vicinity of the Dirac peak.
Okay,
I totally agree with you, but my point is that only the Dirac peak helps to amplify the elastic process. It helps to make it sharp, seen sharper. This is the Dirac peak. The red data is the derivative of the density state. There's one peak at delta, and the second peak is delta plus omega. If there is no coherence peak, this feature will be much weaker. For the P inside, if you have any reaction, you can only see it.
Sasha,
mm-hmm.
So,
if this is actually very way out there, I think actually I can reasonably well approximate it by some sharp peak and then just ship it out here. That's what basically my argument is. The energy of the mode is far enough that you don't worry about the tail. You can do this stupid or simplistic density of space I was showing you, almost like an S-ray. Sharp coherence peak and then you carry density of space outside.
I don't know if it's answering your question.
Well, I'm also wondering about if there is now the mode that's from the analysis now becoming a position effect somehow, right?
Right. And the fact that this mode always rides on top of delta. Look, suppose actually you have a substantial variations of delta. Maybe Shannon should talk, but let me take a step at it. Take delta, which is locally varying, but there is always the same corner living everywhere.
Yeah.
So
remember, the inelastic satellite appears only because there is this in the first place on the hearing peak. So the reason my S, my delta is doing this on the section. Then the satellite will do this. This is because the point, so this is delta. And delta plus omega
most of the functional rights. So this is if I assume that phonon is relatively unaffected by the patchiness and delta. So if the phonon itself is a sharp move, see, everywhere here, it will just add up to the vocal variation of the delta.
Is this based on a calculation or on a guess?
But it depends on the
we actually, we never looked at the inhomogeneous delta. We never looked at the inhomogeneous delta. We looked only at the case where we have self-consistent delta, but basically the pairing strength is everywhere the same homotonic.
Since this is a template function, I still have the notion from your talk about it is of a local mode. And there's a problem for me right now, because you have, as you say, the phonon is the same everywhere in the system. While in your talk, you use that notion, maybe I can
I think local is a technical term that maybe I don't understand, but there's a patch size where you have the same set of observables, that patch size, both for the gap map and for the inelastic processes is about 3 nanometers.
And just for the record, actually, the Fourier transform for inelastic spectroscopy was suggested actually before we saw any data. That's why we put the out there figures which don't agree with Shannon. You know, we obviously would like to have the benefit of knowing what the outcome would be, but the first mode we took for inelastic scattering was a 5-5 spin resonance, because I thought it's so easy to make. It's no brainer, it would be there.
Masha, as the chairman of the session, can I ask that we come back to the Tau 1 question for a second?
Right.
We're supposed to be talking
about the chairman.
Okay. We're supposed to be talking about the mechanism you wanted us to discuss tonight. It seems to me that the existence, even if the tau 1 is as big as the tau 3, it's still amazing that it's there. I would like to understand what the implication of that
is. Possible terms that there are two things going on in the following sense. One would be a straight mechanism, that somehow there is a vibrating object or something in there that comes off of tau 1. Another seems to me that would be more associated with, I want to say, Hamerine-Kittleson, but more associated with the notion of there's a region of suppressed active holes and more holes, and that it's through a thing that might not really be called a mechanism that changes the gap size, and therefore by that there really are two possibilities, yes. At least two possibilities.
So the second case is where the patches have different delocalized fold densities, mm-hmm. and different correlations.
Right, and somehow in that case, maybe what we're seeing is not, maybe it's not quite the way you want to identify. Maybe if you said, oh, it's a phonon or a spin fluctuation, you put a tau 1 in it somewhere. Phonons, you can't do that to usually tau 3. But at any rate, well, you put them in the pairing channel. But it seems to me there are two questions. One is to say it really changed this interaction, and the other is to say it changed something John can tell us better, but something about the striping, something that isn't well described as the exchange of the boson. It seems to me we have two choices. At least.
I would say also that, strictly speaking, what this calculation can do compared to the data is a bigger scattering. So if it's a connection about the mechanism, then we don't know whether it's a, at the moment, actually, this is actually the scattering that shows up as an electric scattering in the data, whether it's a view or not.
The bigger scattering is a sharp pull, and not a gap.
No, we can do this over there boson. It's not a problem. We put this what? I'm sorry. We can put it there a lifetime for this boson and say the feature will get smeared.
Right. That's the point. So you can see them.
Yes, you can see them. Yeah. But
so then the
feature
gets
exactly
in the
phone. Oh yeah, for technical, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I wanted to ask us if you could distinguish between those two cases by making the inelastic measurement correlated with the triggers for this disorder.
I don't know exactly what's going on in this case. How one distinguishes these two, and maybe it's, I'm trying to talk to John, maybe it's not so clear. I shouldn't try and represent, so I don't. Emery or Kittleson or John pointed to you so well, I don't maybe understand it, but it does seem to me that we do have a notion that depending on where you dope it, I mean, you should come in on this because you, as you underdope it, your gap parameter is going up and it's moving around, and somehow or another that strikes me as your mechanism hasn't changed. You haven't done anything locally to change it. You've changed the doping, but it's always the J and whatever. And yet, there's another picture where we've changed the E prime, or we've done really something different. Maybe we've buckled it. And so the boson is really doing something, and that these two are different. My only point is these two maybe are different and should be considered different.
No, I wouldn't necessarily say that. I mean, you could take, we had a long discussion yesterday, we didn't come to any conclusion really, but basically you could take a strongly, you could take a mock insulator with doping and put in the disorder and then try to solve that set of consistently. And you would indeed come to the conclusion that regions with large gaps have also very low local density of integrated density of states. But there was a confusion about trying to correlate that. So the connection to the whole doping is coming out very clearly from just the strong correlations. The connection we were not quite able to make was relating the whole doping with the dopant density. So you see, one would naturally think that wherever the dopants are, that's where the holes would be. And that's somehow giving the opposite correlation. So that's somehow a more of a, some kind of a, one needs to understand quantum chemistry on that scale.
I guess there's also some more complex about how to correlate this Taiwan delta disorder. And this is, so if you, for example, have regular disorder like in those dopants, which modifies density of states, that might lower density of carriers. That might precipitate this competing order would directly then affect the superconducting order parameter, which is observable. And this way, you effectively, so then two things are going to be correlating away, because they can come hand in hand. And then competing order is directly suppressing superconducting, whatever it may be.
I think you don't necessarily need that. Just a strong correlation is able to give that part of the effect. I think what would be nice is this missing puzzle. To see this missing puzzle in Seamus' data in the last part of his talk where he talked about a single layer compound. If he could do, so what he heard from there was this correlation of the gap map and the integrated density of states on the bismuth sample. And then we heard a second part where he showed us how to get the local whole concentration using, this proposal that we have. If these two could be combined, then the mystery is gone. We would know exactly the correlation between the dopants, the whole density, and the gap map. So that would just complete the story. And I'm sure he's thinking about it. This is also something that I guess Vikram should comment on it.
So how did you get there are two things. One is actually it's already gone quite late, right. So we should decide how much we want to continue about this. We can take it for lunch, but what?
I think one word. There was a question about the range of energies that you are integrating over.
Yeah.
So okay. That determines the degree of whole variation from the time.
Okay. So I just wanted to make a quick comment. There's a sociological resistance to allowing the fair interaction to vary freely locally because you think it's somehow unique in the history of supersonicity theory. In fact, there are some little niches of supersonicity theory if you go back and people have made these assumptions. And I think it's fairly well established physics at this point. For example, if you take grain bounding systems of aluminum and niobium, very, very simple systems, in your search and sonar models, which exist in grain boundaries, and these are modeled extremely well, but I'm simply assuming that the pair interaction has a delta function like variation, kind of surface. And it's exactly analogous to the kinds of things they're looking for.
I think that I should just, I don't see why you say it should be, you know, people find it surprising, because the scale that determines on, you know, on what determines the length scale over which delta will vary is a coherence length. And since that is really short.
Exactly. No, no, I'm not saying people should find it surprising. Yeah. I'm just saying that the resistance sometimes that we encounter on the both sides of it indicates that people are surprised.
We do make two because the speakers are and I don't know.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.